start starting next Monday. We're just not getting our work done, so we need to start proceeding a little earlier. For the benefit of those who are in the room and the committee, a roadmap, what is going to happen. We're going to be setting over the work session on House Bill 3119, so if anybody's come for that, that will not be worked today. We're going to hold a brief work session on House Bill 3370, and then we'll be setting over two of the bills that are set for public hearing, House Bill 2190 and House Bill 3318. We do intend to get through the three other bills, 3371, 2904, and 3233. And I realize that there are a lot of people who have turned out for House Bill 2904, which will be our second bill. We'll have to time limit the amount of testimony that we can receive on that so we can get on to the other bill. And we're due on the floor at 10 a.m., so we have a very limited amount of time to receive a lot of information. So everybody's cooperation in getting through our agenda would be much appreciated. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3370. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House Bill 3370 be passed out of the committee without recommendation, and that the bill be moved to House and Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee.
Representative Barker moves that House Bill 3370 be passed out of the committee without recommendation, and that the bill be moved to the House and Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee. Is there any discussion? Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to really object, but just keep in mind, if you read the bill, all the money that had gone to the general fund prior, those, which is a whole lot of money, that would be K-12 funding, is being removed and sent someplace else, would not be in the general fund, available for schools, senior programs. So wherever it goes, everybody needs to know that there's a lot more to this bill than what we're first understood.
I appreciate that input. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I still will vote no on transferring. I think this is much more appropriate to be here. I understand. I'm involved in the drug courts in my county. I work to get the drug courts, but this is talking about funding of them. It's not talking about what they're going to do or how they're going to treat people. It's strictly a funding, which will go through the Criminal Justice Commission account.
Representative
Pump. McPherson, thank you. Do we have a fiscal on this? How much would this either gain for the justice system or lose for the schools?
Representative Comp, we have not heard this bill. We haven't worked this bill. None of that information, and so the situation we're in is we've got close to 300 bills in our committee, and we've got a desire to. From another committee to explore this bill, and in order to give it its fullest and fairest consideration, then I've been prevailed upon to move it to another committee where they want to be giving it that consideration.
Well, Chair, I was only asking because I wanted to know if I needed to lobby any of the members in the next committee.
I see.
Okay. I don't have any disagreement with moving it.
Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I will be voting no on this. I believe in the concept of drug courts, and I believe it's the right end, the wrong means, and I think that this committee would have the right purview to be exploring this. I understand the purpose of the transfer is to discuss treatment options, but I still think that this is the right place to be having that discussion, so I will be voting no.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, I'll also be voting no, and the 5% towards the drug court obviously could be a wellness issue, but I think it also is a judiciary issue. But the big problem with this bill, and it should have a referral, we ought to be referring it to Ways and Means, not to Health and Human Services. Or women's wellness. The problem with this bill is it takes from 44% of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission funds today that go to cities and counties, and it takes all 100% of that money and gives it to cities councils without us even taking a look at it. And this is a huge impact to the general fund, and it's not about the drug courts that I'm objecting to this.
The committee, I would point note for information that there's a subsequent already to Ways and Means on this bill, so it's not as though the issue is what policy committee is going to consider the bill initially, and then the fiscal aspects would be considered in Ways and Means. Let's just go ahead. Is there any further discussion? Then if not hearing any further discussion, we have a motion before us from Representative Barker to move House Bill 3370 out of the committee without recommendation and that the bill be moved to the House Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee. Those are of the opinion that bill should be passed out of the committee without recommendation and moved to the other committee shall say aye. Those opposed shall say no. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Represent
Cameron. No. Represent Flores. No. Represent Pop.
Aye.
Represent Krieger.
No.
Represent
Reed. Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
No.
Chair McPherson.
Aye.
Motion carries. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3370, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3371. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wayne Scott, representative from House District 39. I'm here today to introduce House Bill 3371 on behalf of my constituent, Dan Edgerton. This bill requires homeowners on private road to seek the permission of their neighbors to operate a home-based business that would cause traffic on that private road. As Dan's written testimony describes, private roads can easily be damaged by home-based business that generate traffic greater than what a residential home does. In these cases, homeowners and not local governments have the responsibility to repair and maintain these roads. To improve this bill, there's an amendment that clarifies that home-based businesses having either employees or customers in zoned residential communities using private roads or easements through private property must have unanimous consent of all those who are located on that residential community using these roads or and easements. I would like to conclude my testimony by saying that House Bill 3371 is simply a common-sense bill that will help prevent unnecessary damage to private roads in Oregon and cause taxpayers to pay unnecessary costs to maintain and repair those roads. Mr. Chair, thank you very much for hearing this bill today. I look forward to your enthusiastic support of it.
We have John Gibbons signed up.
Thank you. No, I'm Sean Swearingen, Legislative Assistant to Representative Scott. Unfortunately, the constituent, Dan Edgerton, could not make it today, but he was here yesterday for the whole hearing. He just has a few remarks that he'd like me to make on his behalf.
I'm wondering if you couldn't just submit those for the record. Can do that with cool. The fact that we have another full hearing room and a lot of ground to cover.
Okay. Well, we do have his written testimony being handed out, as well as some informational documents. But I can print out and make copies of the other remarks.
If those remarks could be submitted for the record, I think unless committee members would like to hear them read.
Well, since, Mr. Chair, and since this gentleman is the requester of the bill, I think it would be appropriate, if they're not very long, to just hear them. I would like to hear them verbally. And then
maybe 2 minutes, sir.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Edgerton did go in front of the Clackamas County Commissioner, Martha Schrader, and about this, and it's section 822.03 of Clackamas County Code, and she stated to him that the reason we need a state statute is that the county does not have the financial means to change it at this time, nor in the next couple of years. And that is coming from the Clackamas County Commissioner. And he would like to emphasize that this is reducing residents' rights to security, privacy, and tranquility by permitting increased traffic and strangers into the neighborhoods. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. And we have John Gibbons signed up on this bill as well. Mr. Gibbons?
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Gibbons. I'm an attorney from Tigard. I'm also a
My business is basically representing people that live in homeowners associations, condominiums, and other people affected by common interests such as private road easements. I've submitted some testimony to the committee to say that I'm concerned about this bill. I'm not in opposition to it, because I'll tell you, I know there are situations where some places there shouldn't even be home-based businesses. Difficult situations, people wanting to do too intensive uses on the property, it doesn't make sense. I've seen the amendment that came in on this bill. I think that's a good starting point, because I know that when employees are involved, I've done a number of these kind of cases and taken them as far as the Court of Appeals. Employees create part of the problem in this situation. What I am concerned about is I live in a residential planned community with private roads that we pay for and maintain, and some of my neighbors have home-based businesses to the extent that they have clients and customers come to their homes to pick things up and deal with those kind of things. And living in Southwest Portland and as chair of the Southwest Portland Land Use Committee, I can tell you that in urban areas, it hasn't caused any problems either in relation to my PUD, where we have those streets. It's just part of living in that kind of neighborhood. And I get constituent calls occasionally. I got one this morning from someone calling me and asking me about a zone change or a planning change in Southwest Portland. But I cannot recall in the 3 years that I've been on the Land Use Committee that I've ever had a call from anybody calling me about a home occupation. So while I understand Leader Scott's concern and his constituents' concern, it's a complicated issue of private rights and public regulation. I've worked on the land use, the Real Estate Legislative Committee for 20 years. I've already spoke to Leader Scott and his staff this morning and told them that I would make sure that these committees get to work on it. I guess I'd tell you the last time we worked on a bill that involved easements, and I told you this in my written testimony, it took a session and an interim and another session to get language that dealt with just the private rights involved in the maintenance of an easement. So while I think this bill has some significant merit and needs to be worked on, I know that there are a lot of people in the real estate community and probably some people in the land use community that would like to go a little slower on this and write it up and get it right when we put it in place. And in all candor, having heard now for the first time from Representative Scott what the issue was for his constituent, I wonder if the solution may not be some work in the area of the easement statute that we have now about maintenance, rather than focusing particularly on the land use issues of home occupations. I know that bill ended up being interpreted by the Court of Appeals in a way that surprised me and made it less useful for dealing with issues of maintenance than I had anticipated it would be when we worked on passing it about the early 90s. So there are some issues here certainly need to be addressed. I think there's some opportunities to work on it and make some pretty good legislation. The concerns I have is that it changes property rights and contracts issues in ways that I'm not quite sure we can do right away, but we should address this issue. I thank you for your time,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Quick question for Mr. Gibbons, right?
Sure.
Mr. Gibbons, as I read the bill, is there a it says employees that has employees or customers.
Right.
Would UPS be an employee or a customer?
Legal opinion, probably not.
There's
but that that's a good point, because I know several of my neighbors who have their home-based businesses and don't see customers. And I mean, in all honesty, living on a private road and private street, the biggest problem we have is with the garbage trucks that come in and have gotten progressively bigger over the last 15 years in terms of maintenance of our roads. So, I wouldn't think that UPS would be prohibited, but I'm not saying that some eager lawyer, and I'm sure there are a lot of them out there, might not make that kind of argument. So, you know, I like this bill in some ways. I know that it's not going to solve all the problems related to home-based businesses. There will be more conflicts. I know some of the people that I'm involved with have said, boy, we ought to leave it to local governments. But I just heard that one of the local governments that I work with all the time doesn't have the resources to fix it. So maybe we do need the state to step in on this. It's a difficult and complicated issue. It's difficult to write legislation affecting easements. I can tell you that for a fact from my experience working on the easement bill. It's really difficult to describe the parties accurately even.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Representative Krieger.
Chair. In rural Oregon, we have a lot of roads that not only are access roads to individual homes, but farm, ranch, forestry lands.
Yeah.
Now, if any one of those people wanted to expand their business on that farm, ranch, timber lands to include some type of manufacturing there that was related to what they're doing, it would appear that this would prohibit them from doing that without permission of everybody.
Well, yeah. That's a possibility in rural Oregon, and I guess bringing the hat from my brother's business, I can show you that I understand rural Oregon. Having grown up in southeastern Oregon, it burns. There are a lot of differences between Burns and rural Clackamas County, as we seem to define rural in Clackamas County, and in Portland, where, as I said in my testimony, there's some effort being made to encourage people to basically have home occupations so that the transit benefits can be greater. It's not, and there's some, if I've been reading the Burns Times Herald on a regular basis, I can tell you there's some easement issues and issues of mines and other things in the county that this bill will affect. It's going to reach across the whole state, and it's going to have a lot of different changes in a lot of different areas. It's not, again, my father tried to put a home-based business in on some property we have in the right next to Hines. My dad was an oil company jobber, and he got the wonderful idea, because we're on this property with a hill, that it would be best to move his oil tanks out there and have the trucks come in right there and put the oil in the top, oil and gas in the top, and take it out the bottom when he was taking it out to distribute it. I kind of had to dissuade him from that, telling him there was probably some zoning problems, there was probably some liability problems. Ultimately, at the time of his funeral, I found out why he quit that approach, is because apparently the truck rolled off the hill one day, rolled down the hill, threw a couple of fences, and ended up in the neighbor's chicken coop. And at that point, he decided maybe it wasn't a good idea to have that intensive use on the property. So, and luckily it was Burns, and everything just got settled. But those are the kind of issues that sometimes can come up in these situations. Some significant liability, some significant intensity of use things, which I think the local governments are going to have to be involved in to some degree. But I'm not saying that this bill doesn't highlight some issues that we need to address.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Representative Krieger.
The way it's written, would it affect existing businesses that may have been there even before those other homes were built on that road?
Yes. I believe that it should only be a prospective go-forward bill. I've talked to the legal... I know most of the legal counsel for title companies in the state, and you know, they're sanguine about it because they can write another exemption, but they will tell you that as it exists, it will change existing contract rights. And I hate to say this because I don't want to step off into this can of worms, but one of my colleagues is a member of the board of directors of Oregonians in Action, and when I described this bill to him, the first thing that came out of his mouth is, oh boy, the state's creating a Measure 37 violation. Now, he and I have different, having worked in county government for a number of years, he and I have different views on Measure 37, but at least that's one person's take on this bill. So it needs to be carefully worked through.
Yeah, if I could break in now, we have a hearing room full of people
yes.
who come for a couple of other bills, so unless there are other pressing questions, I think we need to move on. Thank you, Mr. Gibbon.
I appreciate it, and if anybody has any questions, they have my phone number. I'll be glad to answer them.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3371 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2904. And just to roadmap this a little bit, for those in the audience, we have an hour before we have to leave for a floor session, and we have two bills. As I announced earlier, if you're here on House Bills 2190 and 3318, those will not be heard today. And the work session on House Bill 3119 is being carried over as well. So we have an hour to hear two bills, House Bill 2904 and 3233, and I intend to divide that time 40 minutes for House Bill 2904 and the last 20 minutes for House Bill 3233. So we will hear first introduction from Council Stanford, and then we'll begin. What we're going to do is take, since we have a lot of people who are signed up on both sides of this issue on 2904, we're going to start out with the proponents and then go to a panel of opponents back and forth. I'll be using a timer here for after we get after a certain amount of information, just to make sure that we're avoiding repetition. Council.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, and members of the committee. House Bill 2904 is before us first. Under ORS 137.707, if a 15, 16, or 17-year-old defendant is charged with any one of approximately 22 specific offenses, each of which has specific presumptive sentences starting at least 70 months in prison, the defendant must be prosecuted as an adult in criminal court, as opposed to juvenile court. If the defendant is convicted, the court must impose at least the presumptive sentence, which would be 70 months or higher, and the defendant is ineligible for any sort of post-prison supervision release or any reduction in the minimum sentence. House Bill 2904 amends ORS 137.707 to allow 15, 16, or 17-year-old defendants convicted of one or more of the specific crimes that I talked about previously, except not murder, not attempt or conspiracy to commit murder, or assault in the first degree if there was any sort of permanent physical or mental disability to the victim. Such defendants would be eligible for release on post-prison supervision or a minimum sentence reduction if the sentencing court determines that such release is appropriate. To do so, the sentencing court conducts a hearing, and there are specified rules for the hearing, in which it considers factors including but not limited to the person's record, the person's mental, emotional, and physical health, the gravity or loss of the damage caused by the person, victim's safety, and then recommendations of interested parties and organizations.
Okay. Our first panel will consist of David Rogers, Judge Dale Koch, and Barry Crisberg. And I'm not going to specifically time limit you, gentlemen, but I will be watching what time is taken up so that we can make sure that we're being fair as related to the people who are going to be presenting on the other side of this issue.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. I will try and be as brief as possible and actually summarize my testimony. My name is David Rogers. I'm the Executive Director of Partnership for Safety and Justice. We're a statewide advocacy organization whose mission is to strengthen the state's public safety system so it's not only more just, but also more effective. I'm here to strongly support Senate Bill 2904. Essentially, the second look process is built on the premise that we need a different approach for justice and accountability when we're dealing with juveniles. We need to think very carefully before we abandon the future of young people with very long sentences. And in fact, we've actually learned a tremendous amount in the past 12 years since the passage of Measure 11. We've learned that, in fact, young people are not adults, and they develop very, very differently. You'll hear from experts on adolescent behavioral neuroscience and also child development, particularly in relationship to crime and violence, that we need to be treating young people differently. So Second Look is a recognition that young people are still far from fully mature. And it provides, and in fact, that notion provides the rationale for many of the laws around the country that prevent juveniles from marrying without parental consent, from voting, and also from serving on juries. So we need to treat young people differently. Very simply put, also, Second Look is a process that works. Department of Justice has been tracking Second Look hearings since 1998. And in that time, 290 Second Look hearings have taken place. Less than half of the youth who have had a Second Look hearing have been granted conditional release. Actually, 141 to be exact. And so what that says is that the process is discerning. Judges are making good decisions. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card by any means. Additionally, the Department of Corrections reports that the recidivism rate for youth who have been granted conditional release is actually quite low. It's only 20%. So of that 141 young people who are granted conditional release under Second Look, only 29 offenders, in fact, recidivated. So that's a 20% rate compared to the state's, the adult system's 31% recidivism rate. So my sense is that the numbers show that judges are making the right decisions and the process works. It's also worth noting then that Second Look really strengthens public safety. And you'll hear more about research that shows that essentially the youth who are treated as adults within the criminal justice system recidivate more often. That says to me that we need a different approach when we're really taking a public safety perspective. And, you know, it seems like we would want a system that's really designed to assess and release prisoners when the time is right. In fact, particularly when before they're really hardened by actually moving into the adult system. Because the Oregon Youth Authority, in fact, has a number of programs that have been very effective at rehabilitating young people. And it's worth noting that those programs are just not available in the adult prison system. A few other things. The public supports this. So a little over a year ago, we commissioned a poll of statewide registered likely voters in Oregon on a range of public safety issues. 61% of Oregon's registered likely voters support a Second Look for youth convicted of a Measure 11 crime. You'll hear more from Barry Crisberg, the director of the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, about national polling. There's strong public support for this. And really, just in summary, it's worth noting that we've learned a great deal since the passage of Measure 11 about adolescent development, recidivism rates for youth treated as adults, and the root causes of youth crime. All that information adds up to the need for shifting our public safety strategy. Providing a Second Look to youth convicted of Measure 11 crime makes a tremendous amount of sense. This is also not a major overhaul to Measure 11. This is a very modest reform focused specifically on the way youth, young people, our sons, our daughters, our granddaughters and grandsons are impacted if they're caught up in the system. And it creates a process that's thoughtful to make sure that we don't throw away the lives easily of young offenders. And lastly, very quickly, I would say that you may hear from the opposition that to this that their sense is that they think that any change to Measure 11 is problematic because, you know, Measure 11 works. And I'd say if that is an issue that is really of concern, I would have plenty of information to share at a later date after this hearing, which you know, questions the efficacy of Measure 11. And you can start with the state's very own report that was the state of Oregon commissioned the RAND Corporation to do, which shows, in fact, that there's no direct relationship between Measure 11 and the decrease in crime that the state has experienced.
Judge Koch.
Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dale Koch, and I'm a judge in Portland, Oregon. I'm here as an individual judge, not representing the judicial department, because obviously there are fiscal impacts and other issues here in regard to this bill. But I'm also here as president of the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges. That's a national organization. It's now 70 years old. Of juvenile and family court judges and other professionals that work in this area, 1,800 members around the country, including 50 members here in the state of Oregon. And I'm privileged to be the president of that organization this year. We participated in the development of the juvenile delinquency guidelines that were released in 2005. That was a project funded by the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention in the Department of Justice at the federal level. And so I'm going to just keep my comments very brief. I've got some written testimony that I'll provide. The context of this is that this country and this state has recognized for over 100 years that the juveniles are, in fact, different. They are not just small adults. They're actually children. And there are reasons that we need to be addressing them differently than we address adults. The first juvenile court in this country was formed in 1899 in Chicago, and the first juvenile court in this state was in 1905 here in Multnomah County. It recognizes the juvenile court must balance public safety, youth accountability, and victim restoration when we're making decisions involving the youth in front of us. It also recognizes that we need to be taking individualized responses regarding the youth that are in front of us instead of trying to treat each and every one of them as exactly the same person and with that expecting that the same result or same response will work over each of them. There's lots of research, and you're going to hear about it, regarding the individualized interventions. There's research by the MacArthur Foundation and many other organizations that will that you'll hear about and receive evidence about, I'm sure, through the process of this hearing. The judges that are going to be making this decision are not just going to be juvenile court judges. And, in fact, in many of our jurisdictions, we were talking about Burns in the prior testimony. Well, there's one judge in Burns. He is the juvenile judge, the civil judge, the criminal judge. He is the judge, in fact, in both Grant and Harney counties. But the judges that are doing this work and making these decisions are very well trained. They don't make these decisions lightly. These are going to be hard hearings to hold because there's going to be a lot of pressure on both sides to make the decisions. And quite frankly, from judges' perspective, it'd be a lot easier if this didn't pass. It's a lot easier if we don't have to be in the middle of making those difficult decisions. But that's not what we're elected to do. We're elected to make difficult decisions, and we're elected to hear the evidence and try to come up with a resolution that holds the youth accountable for their behavior, that delivers clear consequences for illegal behavior, and teaches youth necessary behavior change. That's what our responsibility is. So I just want to make it clear I'm not here taking a position on this bill one way or the other, but I do support the principles in this bill, which are individualized justice for juvenile offenders and a recognition that we should be intervening in a way that's going to most effectively reduce future criminal behavior. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Koch. Dr. Crisberg.
Hi, I'm Barry Crisberg. I'm president of the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, which this year is celebrating its 100th anniversary as the nation's oldest criminal justice research organization. I'm also very honored to be back in Oregon for many, many years. Senator Mark Hatfield was a valued and important member of our board, and as I was driving up here, I brought back memories because my son attended the University of Oregon and was a stellar rugby player for the Ducks. I want to address two issues. One, this public safety issue. There has been, I wouldn't say extensive research, but there have been a number of studies going back to the middle 80s that have taken place in Ohio, in Minnesota, in Florida, in Arizona, in Utah, and in New York State. And in every instance, the research showed that comparable youth who were sent to the adult system, compared to youth in the juvenile system, had significantly higher recidivism rates. And an analysis we did of federal data from the National Correctional Reporting Program showed that on a national level, these findings hold. To me, the most impressive study is a study done by Professor Jeffrey Fagan at Columbia University in New York. He took advantage of the natural experiment of New York State having a very low age of prosecuting kids in the adult system and New Jersey using 18. He developed match samples of youth based on every variable he could get his hands on from these two states, New Jersey and New York, and again found in a number of repeated studies doing this matching that the New Jersey youth who were kept in the juvenile system had significantly lower recidivism rates than the comparable youth who were tried in the adult system. I know of no study that has demonstrated anything other than this. And these studies have been done by a broad range of very reputable researchers, including the research arm of the National Council of Juvenile Court Judges and people across the country. So I think the issue of public safety is pretty much settled. That is, the decision to place young people in the adult system is a recipe for increasing recidivism in crime, not decreasing it. There has been, by the way, very little to no evidence that there's a deterrent effect. And some of that has to do with what we alluded to earlier. Teenagers are not reading the newspapers and tracking what you're doing in the legislature. The notion that increasing penalties is going to influence the very emotional and short-term decision-making that young people make is just not proven by the research. So I want to raise that issue. The other thing on the issue of public opinion, since it's been 12 years since 11 was passed in this state, and a lot has happened in that period of time. And I think back 12 years ago, if we polled people, we probably would have found a significant support for this. But this is no longer the case. And I have copies here for the committee of a poll which we commissioned in January of 2007. Through the Zogby International Organization. This is a random telephone poll of 1,000 likely voters, and I just want to share with you some of the findings. Generally, the public is concerned about youth crime. They haven't gone to sleep on this issue. And they have concerns that we need to strengthen the juvenile justice system. But by 15-1, they believe that the decision to try a juvenile as an adult should be done on a case-by-case basis and by a judge. The least favorable category is to allow a prosecutor to make this decision. The public does not believe by an overwhelming amount, again, these numbers are two-thirds, three-quarters, does not believe that that putting kids in the adult system deters them. In fact, the public believes it makes them worse. Again, by and large, what the public is saying is they would like these decisions made on a case-by-case basis by a trained judge in an open, transparent setting where evidence can be introduced and the full facts can be brought to bear, not in some back room of a prosecutor's office without public scrutiny or really public accountability. Last thing I'd say is this, and I just want to end by, as a father, and I know we have some parents and grandparents around the table. Think about your children and your grandchildren. And think about, God forbid, a situation where you get a call in the middle of the night saying that that child got into a car with a high school friend, ended up being at the wrong place at the wrong time, and now they're charged with some very serious crime. They may have only been a bystander. You know, they were sitting outside when something terrible happened. My question to you is, wouldn't you want second look for your child, for your grandchild? And if you, and I think most of us would say yes, we would want a justice system that would look very carefully at all aspects of our family member to make a just decision. If that's good enough for our kids, it should be good enough for all kids. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Committee, I'm not going to take any questions in view of where we are in terms of timing. Excuse this panel and our first panel opponents.
We're going to need to have some questions because they're making these statements that the voters all want this and that one. 75% of the voters.
Yeah, but Representative Barker, let's get the input, and then we're not moving this today. We're educating ourselves.
I guess we're not moving it, period. But
yeah,
thank
I understand.
You.
I understand. The opponents panel is Steve Dole, John Foote, and Bob Herman. And gentlemen, that last panel took just over 15 minutes, so I'm going to urge you to conclude your remarks within that amount of time in total. And in whatever order, Steve, do you want to, Mr. Dole, do you want to go first?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of Crime Victims United, and I'd like to shed some historical perspective in what we do here in Oregon. This is not about Ohio, Minnesota, Arizona, Utah, Florida, New York, New Jersey. This is about Oregon. This is not about national polls. This is about Oregon. I have to say one thing right off the top, and I think the DAs will back me up. Bystanders to crime don't end up in prison if they're just a bystander. From 1987 to 1993, Oregon's juvenile crime rate rose 67%. During that same time period, the overall juvenile crime rate rose by over 100%. Not only did the number of violent crimes increase dramatically, but so did their severity in the form of more aggravated assaults, armed robberies, forcible rapes, and murders. A number of high-profile cases involving extremely violent juveniles brought the issue of juvenile remand to the attention of the legislature. Among them were the killings of Scott Bell and Jeffrey Walters. Two juveniles took Scott Bell into the hills of Clackamas County, bound him with duct tape, shot him execution style in the back of the head. The judge refused to remand the 17-year-old killer. He was sent to McLaren, where he bragged that he wanted to be a mobster and always wanted to murder someone execution style. He said he got away with it. He said he fooled everyone, including, and with all due respect to judges, this is his quote, "that stupid judge." The killer was set free 4 years later as soon as he turned 21. Jeffrey Walters was stabbed to death by Ryan Pingle in 1990 in Multnomah County. The judge refused to remand the 17-year-old killer. He, too, was set free 4 years later as soon as he turned 21. In 1993, the Oregon legislature considered House Bill 2994, which covered first-degree violent crimes. It passed in the House on a 51-7 vote. It then went to the Senate. Indications were that the votes were on the floor to pass it, but House Bill 2994 died in committee upon adjournment in August. Less than 1 month after the bill died, 22-year-old Tim Hawley nearly died when he was savagely attacked in the Lloyd Center's mall by three juveniles. Tim and his fiancée were leaving a movie theater. He was tackled, beaten, and kicked in the head until unconscious, then thrown down a flight of stairs. In order to save his life, the doctor had to remove the front portion of Hawley's brain. To this day, Tim Hawley is severely disabled. The primary participants both had substantial juvenile court records. One was on probation for raping a 4-year-old. The other perpetrator had been previously referred to juvenile authorities for participating in a similar gang beating. Nonetheless, the juvenile court judge again refused to waive either youth to adult court for trial. Both were free as soon as they turned 21. The law at the time required that violent juveniles receive a remand hearing before a juvenile court judge. Violent juvenile criminals who were convicted in juvenile court were sent to juvenile detention where they could be released at any time by authorities. Victims never knew when the juvenile would be released, and under no circumstances could these violent juveniles be held past their 21st birthday. Once they were released, there was no post-prison supervision and the criminal record was not available to the public. This was the state of juvenile justice when Measure 11 was placed on the ballot in 1994. The measure stipulated minimum mandatory sentences for aggravated assault, armed robbery, kidnapping, child molestation, forcible rape, manslaughter, and attempted murder and murder. It required 15, 16, and 17-year-olds charged with these crimes to be tried in an adult court, and you have in front of you the voters pamphlet from that year, and you can see that it's very clear that it's 15 and over, and you can see it's very clear on the third page what the crimes are and what the punishments are. Among the voter pamphlet arguments that year was this argument. If a 15-year-old robs a classmate of a hat, the mandatory sentence would be 7.5 years in prison. 12.5 years later, we are still waiting for the first 15-year-old hat robber to be sentenced under Measure 11. From 1995 to 2002, arrests of juveniles for violent crimes dropped 38%. Despite the well-documented misrepresentations of Measure 11 opponents, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds convicted of Measure 11's crimes are not sent to adult prison. Every one of them is placed in the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority, where they live in dormitories, attend school, receive counseling treatment, are taught self-discipline, and participate in sports and other activities. In most cases, the school attendance, the counseling treatment, and self-discipline would not be happening except for Measure 11. The recidivism is low, as stated, and that's because OYA has done a good job. Because most Measure 11 sentences are 8 years or less, all juveniles convicted of Measure 11 crimes can serve their entire sentence at the Oregon Youth Authority. There are only three ways in which juveniles are sent to adult prison. First, they commit a serious violent crime against staff or peers. Second, they refuse to attend school and engage in treatment. And third, if they reach their 18th birthday and persistently request to be transferred to adult prison. The number of juveniles currently in adult prisons in Oregon is zero. Since the passage of Measure 11, the legislature, at the request, and this is important, at the request of Crime Victims United and law enforcement, has modified the measure twice. In 1997, Senate Bill 1049 created exceptions for Assault 2, Robbery 2, and Kidnapping 2. Under these exceptions, a judge can depart below the Measure 11 sentence as far down as probation in cases where the criminal had no prior serious felony convictions, a deadly weapon was not used, and the victim did not suffer severe significant injury. These exceptions have been frequently used, and the RAND Corporation, which was addressed before, a report on Measure 11, analyzed the data from 1999. They reported at that time that Senate Bill 1049 exceptions was used in 27% of Robbery 2 cases, 36% of Assault 2 cases, and 48% of Kidnap 2 cases. Their report did not break down the difference between juveniles and adults, but it is virtually certain that exception rates for juveniles are much higher. In 2001, again, the legislature, again at the request of Crime Victims United and law enforcement, created exceptions for all second-degree sex offenses and sex abuse one in cases where the criminal had no prior serious felony record or sex offenses. With these legislative changes, a significant proportion of juveniles who have committed second-degree crimes or sex abuse in the first degree receive sentences that are shorter than the sentence that they would get under second look without the need for an additional hearing. Some even get probation. And I'll wrap it up, Mr. Chair. When looking at what left are the crimes in which victims suffered death or significant injury, a deadly weapon was used, or the criminal had a serious prior conviction, or all of the above. These are the cases that HB 2904 would be looking at. Under 2904, victims would be subjected to years of uncertainty about when the criminal would be released, followed by yet another painful hearing in which their trauma would be laid bare again. HB 2904 would be harmful to victims, law-abiding citizens, and even to juvenile violent criminals themselves. It is an affront to the voters who have twice given Measure 11 an overwhelming vote of confidence. It's bad policy, and it should be rejected, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dole.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Foote. I serve as the president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm here this morning really to let you know that the Oregon District Attorneys Association strongly opposes this bill. For really very straightforward reasons. There's been 12 years to look at the application of Measure 11, to look at how it's been applied, to see if it's been applied fairly, to see if it's had an effect on the safety for the public, to see if it's treated juveniles in a fair way. And I think the record is just absolutely clear. And what I encourage you to do is check the real facts about how Measure 11 has been applied in this state. That's the bottom line. You have all the information you need. The truth is, it's been a roaring success. And that is not to say that kids going into custody isn't a tragedy. But the vast number of kids are not under Measure 11. The vast number. They're still in the juvenile system. That's a fact. And this is not scooping up innocent kids who need to be treated differently. Those kids aren't in this system. We're dealing with the kids who have done the most serious crimes in this state. And I think the record shows this law has been applied fairly and in a very discerning way. Prosecutors have taken this law very seriously. We've taken the responsibilities that we've been given under this law very seriously, as has everybody else in the system. OYA has done an outstanding job of dealing with these kids. And I think If you look at the record honestly, you'll see it's a success. So we encourage you to leave the law as it is, and we ask you to do that, the entire association. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vett.
Thank you.
Mr. Herman.
Chairman Pearson, members of the committee, my name is Bob Herman. I'm the district attorney in Washington County. I've been a prosecutor in Washington County for 32 years and the elected district attorney for the last nine. And of course, I echo the comments of the others here at the table this morning. But one thing I'd like to emphasize in the application of Measure 11, my experience in Washington County, we're not talking about juveniles that have tipped over outhouses or egged cars or toilet-papered streets and houses. We're talking about crimes that are the most serious that we deal with. This bill would allow a cut in half of the sentencing for a forcible rape, a forcible sodomy, a attempted murder, a manslaughter. These are the most serious crimes, with the exception of homicide, that we deal with in the prosecution. And I would point out that for all of us who have children, it's a very serious concern if anyone is involved in the criminal system, but it's a very serious concern if any one of my children or yours or any others are the victims of these perpetrators. And I simply say that from my experience, it, as Mr. Foote has said, it's been handled very well. It's been handled very fairly. It's been handled very openly in this state. And it's bad public policy to say for these types of violent crimes, we're going to cut the sentence in half if you're 15, 16, or 17. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Herman.
Mr. Gentleman. We're going to go to our next panel, Alex Stevens, Julie McFarland, and Judge Kip Leonard. And as I indicated before, it's my intention to close this hearing at in 10 minutes. So if you could collectively hold yourselves to about 5 minutes so that we get one more panel of folks on the other side up before we have to go to other business.
I guess I've been selected to go first. My name is Kip Leonard. I'm a circuit judge in Eugene. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. As Judge Koch said, he was here as an individual judge. I am as well. I'm not speaking on behalf of the judicial branch or anybody other than myself. I've been a judge for 21 years. I've been the juvenile judge in Lane County for 9 of the last 14. So I have been a judge both prior to Measure 11 and after Measure 11 was placed into effect. I was also, by background, I've been a prosecutor. I was associate member of the Criminal Justice Council, developing the sentencing guidelines back in the late 80s, and have participated in a good number of activities regarding youth and the variety of issues that come before juvenile court. Measure 11 is a, as it's applied to juveniles, is a punitive approach to juvenile crime and one that the voters decided to take. I agree with Judge Koch's testimony and also his written testimony that it gets away from what we have done in the juvenile system for quite some time, for over 100 years now, and that is to treat juveniles individually. It is clear in my experience that you get the attention of juveniles, you get the attention of adults as well, with punishment. That is very clear. There's nothing like the reality of being locked up. However, in my experience, you don't punish young people into maturity and you don't punish them into success. As a friend of mine who works in juvenile criminal justice said, there's no substitute for experience like being 16. You know it all at 16. You know a lot less at 18, and you know a lot less at 58. If what we are trying to do is change the behavior of those who have committed crimes that are of great concern to the community, I think that one of the things that we need to do is take advantage of the opportunity when we get their attention to do those things that are more than just punishment, and that we don't rely on punishment as being the key to success. We have an opportunity, and we should take the opportunity as good public policy to review the progress that people have made and take advantage of opportunities that they present themselves to take a different approach if a different approach is appropriate. I think it's bad public policy, quite frankly, to keep somebody incarcerated just because they are there. It is a waste of resources. It's a waste of bed space that we can use for other offenders. It's a waste of opportunity to improve the lives of the individuals that we are talking about. It's interesting as we talk about as punishment and incarceration in institutions, as somehow we always think of it as the default position, the thing that always is going to work. Well, the research tends to show that it doesn't necessarily do that. And I just offer you this example. I think that all of us as parents want for our children, we want them to be in the best schools. The legislature is spending an awful lot of its time this session, rightly so, worrying about the status of education, whether it be K through 12 or higher education. We all want the best schools for our children. We want them to be in schools where they're going to have the best teachers. We want them to be in schools where they have the best opportunity to learn. And we want them to be in schools where they are going to be with other students who are going to help them make that sort of progress. It's interesting, however, that we take the converse approach when we deal with those people that are of concern to us and whose behavior we really want to change because they are threats to us. We put them with people who are not going to be help them be successful. We put them in situations where they don't have those teachers, where the people who they are with are people that we don't want them to learn from. And we somehow think that keeping them there longer and longer when we don't need to in those situations where they have shown change is somehow going to be productive for society. This bill, in my estimation, gives us the opportunity to take a look at those who are motivated, who have made progress, and who can benefit from a different approach other than punishment. Thank you.
My name is Alexander Stevens. I'm an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience at Oregon Health and Science University. I'm here today representing my reading of the scientific literature of adolescent brain development. And I'll keep my comments short because of the time, but I want to address three issues. One is the nature of adolescent decision making. The second is adolescent brain development. And the third is really how these two come together and how adolescent brain development underlies adolescent decision making, and that this change in brain development over time means that someone who commits a crime at 15 may be a very different person and have very different capacities than the same person at 21. I gave you a handout that I hope will help you follow my remarks. Juveniles between the age of 10 and 24 have an extremely high mortality rate compared to younger children and compared to adults. It's surprising because this is probably the healthiest time of our lives. Yet, the cause of those deaths are motor vehicle accidents, other unintentional injuries such as jumping off a bridge without testing the water first, homicide, and suicide. In fact, those categories account for about 70% of the deaths in adolescents. I would argue that all those types of deaths are due to poor decision-making. The reason for this is that the brain has not reached full maturity. In the last 12 to 15 years, the development of technologies such as magnetic resonance imaging have allowed us to study the normal developing brain in ways that we were never able to before. What we understand now about the development of the brain is that it takes place in stages and it takes place over a long period of time, with the brain not reaching full development until the mid-20s. That's much later than we had previously expected. Importantly, the last area of the brain to mature is the frontal lobes. The frontal lobes is the part of the brain that is critical to decision making, the integration of strategic planning and emotional information, and essentially allows us to take into account both the current situation, past information, and information provided to us by our peers and our surroundings. The fact that the brain doesn't reach full development until the mid-20s explains quite a bit about adolescent behavior. If you look at adolescent behavior, as I just mentioned, the rates of mortality are very high, usually because of very poor critical judgment. We see that. That's one of the reasons why we've been modifying the licensure for driving for adolescents, removing the ability of adolescents to drive a car with other peers. Why is that? Part of the reason is because when peers are together, adolescents make very, very bad decisions, in part because they are very susceptible to peer influences as they become less and less tied to the family. As a result, they become distracted, they make decisions in the moment that they know are very poor at any other time. And this not only accounts for their traffic accidents, it accounts for other accidents, it accounts for homicides, and it accounts for suicides. All these things have a very enormous impact on the families and the loved ones of those around them. Finally, I just want to point out again that the changes that are occurring primarily in the frontal lobes of the brain, these areas that are critical to judgment. When an adolescent makes a decision at 15, he's making a decision that's very, very different from the decision he might make at 21. What this bill would do was allow people to look at the changes that have taken place in the development of the brain, something that individuals really don't have much control over. But what this bill would allow is people to look at this individual and their decision-making capacities at the age of 21 rather than continue to assume that they would make the same decisions they made at age 15 or 16 or 17. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Stevens. We'll have time for just one more panel on this bill, and the three we're going to...
Oh, I'm sorry. We have... I beg your pardon, Ms. McFarland. I was brushing away
with you
too quickly.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, and I will try to be brief. My name is Julie McFarlane. I am a supervising attorney and founder of the Juvenile Rights Project. I have submitted written testimony from the Juvenile Rights Project in favor of this bill. I also have submitted written testimony from the Oregon Research Institute and the Oregon chapter of the National Association of Social Workers, the Oregon chapter of that, and you have those. So very briefly, our office represents about children in about 3,000 cases a year. We have 22 attorneys doing that. A little less than a quarter of these cases are now delinquency cases. We used to have about 50%, but the juvenile crime rate has gone down so dramatically that our caseload has also gone down dramatically. This year, for the first time since the passage of Measure 11, we have suspended our Measure 11 representation contract with the state. When we originally undertook to represent 15, 16, and 17-year-olds charged with Measure 11 crimes, it was because we felt that our expertise and experience over 30 years of working with juveniles would assist us in these cases and assist our juvenile clients, and that we would be more qualified to do that. The reality and the reason that we suspended our contract is that that is just not the case. There is no point in a Measure 11 case where the development, the individual situations of the child or youth are considered. The power is completely with the district attorney to make a determination on what is going to happen to the case. And as most defense attorneys will tell you, our clients are faced with taking an offer they cannot refuse.
Ms. McFarland, we're well beyond the time that I'd allotted to this panel, so if you could make just a very concluding remark.
So we are urging the committee to pass this bill out to restore some balance to the juvenile system and consideration of the needs of children.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. McFarland. I'm going to extend this hearing another 5 minutes so we can hear from another panel of opponents. We'll hear from Mark McDonald, Donna Maynard, and Becky Williams.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is Mark McDonald. I'm a senior deputy district attorney from Multnomah County. I've been a prosecutor for 27 years. Today I've delivered to you a letter from Mr. Schrunk asking you to vote against Measure 2904. Immediately prior to the passage of Measure 11, I was the senior deputy in charge of our juvenile unit in Multnomah County. I handled many of the remand hearings there. I was the deputy that handled the beating of Tim Holley, in which the three individuals beat him mercilessly, threw him down a flight of stairs, and caused permanent brain damage. Two of those individuals had extensive juvenile records. One I had prosecuted a year earlier for raping his four-year-old cousin. He had been ordered to be in treatment, but had not attended a single treatment session in a year, and also had been involved in other assaults. Despite his record, despite the horrific crime, he was not remanded and was released from custody at age 21. But I won't go into the details of that. I just summarize a couple of things. The biggest problem with 2904 is what it does to victims. It forces victims to live under a cloud of doubt for several years, not knowing whether or not their perpetrator is going to serve their full sentence. And this is really a stumbling block for their recovery, putting their life back together, this doubt of what's going to happen. And then it forces them to come back at some later time to face their offender again, face to face. So they're re-victimized a second time, and that's unconscionable. The other thing I'd like to summarize is that there's only two things I've learned in my 27 years of prosecution. Is one is that the only predictor of future dangerousness violence is past behavior. Someone who's committed a violent crime in the past is much more likely to do so again in the future. And the second thing is that young offenders are much more likely to act spontaneously because they are immature, and to be much more spontaneous. And that the biggest factor in recidivism is age, that the older a person gets, the less likely they are to commit an offense. That study after study after study has shown that at age 24, 25, the rate of recidivism drops dramatically. So what Measure 11 does, and why it's been so successful, is taken the most violent offenders, those who's most likely to act out again, and has simply removed them from society for a significant period of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McDonald. Let's go to Ms. Maynard. And I'm going to have to, unfortunately, in view of the time, have to put a two-minute clock on here. I apologize for that.
All right. I apologize. I woke up yesterday without a voice. And my name is Donna Maynard, and I'm here representing crime victims as well as Crime Victims United. And I'm here today in opposition to House Bill 2904. In August of 1997, I was brutally attacked in my own home by my own son. I was stabbed 13 times with a butterfly knife that had a 6-inch blade and with barber shears. He was exactly 52 days from turning 16 years old. And I want to say that I have brought actual crime scene photos so that you can see what attempted murder looks like. Prior to the attack, if I'd heard a story like mine, my first question would have been, what was going on in this home that would make a child act out like this? I would have judged that there must have been abuse, drugs, poor parenting, or no parenting. And the truth was, my child was always loved. He was taught right from wrong and from good from bad. And he was appropriately disciplined when needed. He had consistent rules and parenting. And he was taught about consequences and about choices. Unless you've stood in my shoes, you have no idea how devastating it is to stand in front of a mirror look yourself in the eyes and admit to yourself and to God that you have given birth to someone who not only can hurt but who can kill. I can understand how parents feel who have children who have harmed or killed others. If my son had hurt or killed someone else somewhere inside of me, I would have held the hope that he really didn't mean to do it, that he just made a poor choice.
Ms. Maynard, you're just approaching 2 minutes, so if you could conclude. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Williams.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Becky Williams, and I'm here to oppose House Bill 2904. My husband and I are the parents of Jessica Williams on May 22, 2003. Jessica was brutally assaulted, tortured, robbed, and murdered in Portland by the members of a street family headed by James Nelson. James Nelson, I might add, had been convicted of a prior murder, but because he was a juvenile at the time, and because Measure 11 did not exist, he served less than 11 years. He had only been released 2 months before he led the assault, torture, robbery, and murder of our daughter. 13 people were convicted of that felony crime in connection with her death. Today, in light of the subject matter of 2904, I would like to focus on three of those convicted who would have been affected by this proposed law. While I recognize it would not apply to our case, I want to bring home to you the effect it would have on future victims' families like ours. Crystal Ivy received a sentence of 3 years for kidnapping, robbery, and assault. Crystal Elliott received a sentence of 5 years for assault, kidnapping, and robbery. Sarah Castor received a sentence of 5 years for assault. To a future victim's family in a similar situation, this bill would mean that a year and a half and also 2.5 years after sentencing, we would have to have 3 separate trials about whether these 3 defendants would really serve their full sentences. During that time, a family like ours would be re-victimized by having to go through the process of determining what their real sentence would be while having to relive the crime all over again. We are still so raw 4 years after our daughter's murder that we have not been able to do the task of going through her things. We still cannot talk or think about our darling daughter's
Ms. Williams, I'm sorry, but we are at 2 minutes, so if you could just make a concluding remark.
Well, I'm sure this is not what Oregon voters have overwhelmingly voted for twice. We hope that you will oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much to this panel. And I apologize to those who didn't get a chance to testify on House Bill 2904. If this bill is set for hearing again, we will have the sign-up lists, and the people who came today and were not heard will be taken first in order. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2904 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3233. And we will take an initial an introduction from Council Stanford and then the first panel.
House Bill 3233. Thank you, Chair McPherson. House Bill 3233 makes legislative findings regarding the evaluation, treatment, and monitoring of sex offenders. It establishes the titles of Certified Sex Offender Therapist, Certified Associate Sex Offender Therapist, and Certified Sexual Arousal Interest Examiner, and provides specific criteria for such certification. House Bill 3233 creates a board, a sex offender treatment board, to certify and maintain a registry of such certified positions and to develop evidence-based standards and practices for treatment and monitoring. It also creates a sex offender treatment advisory board to make recommendations to the main board. House Bill 3233 provides for confidentiality and communications between the certified therapist, examiners, and their patients, with some exceptions. These exceptions include patient's consent, legal action, statements regarding criminal intent, and information regarding victims who are minors. There are civil penalties for persons that falsify certification. The board appears to be funded through such fines and through the collection of fees from persons seeking certification as therapists or examiners. There is a -1 amendment which declares an emergency and alphabetizes definitions, and a -2 amendment which I believe incorporates the -1 and then also places the board under the jurisdiction of the health licensing agency.
Thank you, Council. And if I could get the attention of those, if you have conversations going on, please take them out in the hall. We've still got another bill we're hearing. Our first panel today will be Heather Hutanen, Stephen Jensen, and John Harkins.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and committee members. My name is Heather Hutan, and I'm the training director with the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force, and I realize we have a very short period of time. I just want to point out that I've, in addition to my own testimony, I've also submitted a little background on the task force and its initiation, as well as testimony from Ms. Catherine Gotch, who is the clinical services director in Multnomah County and also a treatment and provider and evaluator, as well as Crime Victims United, Steve Dole, and additionally Jeff Woods, who is a Marion County probation officer and is also a member of the Oregon Community Corrections Directors Association and the Oregon Sex Offender Supervision Network. So on behalf of the task force, I'm pleased to offer testimony in support of House Bill 3233. This concept was developed in collaboration with Oregon sex offender supervision and treatment providers. It's been requested by the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force and the Oregon Sex Offender Supervision Network, and as you know, is sponsored by Chair McPherson of the House Judiciary. The intent of House Bill 3233 is to create a sex offender treatment and certification board that will develop a certification process for professionals who work with sexual offenders that will create evidence-based standards and guidelines for the treatment of sexual offenders, and ultimately will certify approved applicants who will be providing treatment to sex offenders. House Bill 3233 will also create the titles of clinical sex offender therapist, certified associate sex offender therapist, and certified arousal interest examiner. In practice, this will mean that only those individuals who meet the minimum criteria for these titles will be able to use these titles after certification through the board. The task force believes that House Bill 3233 is an important piece of public policy for the 2007 legislative session, to the extent that sex offender treatment providers, in conjunction with supervision and management professionals, assume a vital and critical role in protecting the public from offenders who remain in the community. To the extent that the protection of the community can be undermined by a lack of regulated and approved practices, to the extent that treatment professionals who have been charged with reducing recidivism and rehabilitating sex offenders are really in need of specific training, skills, and education in order to accomplish their work. And finally, to the extent that providing convicted or adjudicated sex offenders with quality supervision and treatment will increase their chances of successful rehabilitation and integration back into our communities. As you most likely already know, community supervision of sexual offenders in Oregon is almost exclusively the responsibility of counties, including the identification of approved sex offender treatment providers. This responsibility may pose a challenge, particularly for smaller counties where staff and financial resources are an issue, to go through this identification and authorization process for individuals who are treating sex offenders. In addition to that, if each of Oregon's 36 counties have different criteria and guidelines for the identification and selection of approved sex offender treatment providers, then the citizens of Oregon can expect inconsistent practices at best and ineffective practices at worst with respect to treatment of sexual offenders. So certainly it is the hope of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force that this legislative assembly will join us in addressing the need for professional standards and guidelines to establish sex offender treatment providers as a specialization within mental health providers, that certification for sex offender treatment providers who meet evidence-based practices and standards, and also importantly, an administrative system that will be available to community corrections and the public to verify the names, titles, and credentials of those who are certified. So I would like to finish my testimony by pointing out our amendments, proposed amendments dash 1 and dash 2. Dash 1 amendments are really what I would call technical cleanups to the bill that we worked on in collaboration with a variety of stakeholders, two of whom are here today at the panel with me. And then proposed amendments two are really moved forward in collaboration with the Oregon Health Licensing Agency because we believe that we found, in essence, a home for the board and that the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, with its existing infrastructure for administrative support of boards and advisory committees who certify and license professionals, that they have the infrastructure and the systems in place to support the work of this board. I would also like to note that amendments dash two do include the technical cleanups from dash one, and that we are in strong support of using dash two amendments. And in addition to that, just to point out that one of the particularly important technical issues is the issue of the grandfather clause, which for your purposes is page 11, section 11.2b of dash 2, that there is a reference to the Oregon Health Licensing Agency determining an appropriate mechanism for a time-limited grandfather clause. We just want to have on record that we very much support that and that our stakeholders are very invested in seeing that come to fruition. Additionally, I would like to say that I spoke with Phil Lemon from the Oregon Youth Authority yesterday afternoon, and he indicated that there may still be a few technical cleanups that are very specific to the juvenile system. We certainly don't object to those and plan to work in collaboration with OYA to make sure that this is sound public policy in every respect. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hutanen. We have really literally just 2 minutes here left. But so, gentlemen, whatever introductory material would be helpful to the committee to get oriented to the bill, with recognizing there are further amendments.
Yeah.
We have an amendment we just received today and further amendments coming, just so we have the background so that we can work intelligently when this bill comes back.
Okay.
In whatever order you wish.
I guess I'm going to speak for a moment. Literally.
And I apologize for just things got out of
Chairman
out of control
and board members or representatives. I'm Steve Jensen. I've worked in the sex offender field for 34 years. I'm past president of the International Organization of Sex Offender Treaters. I was the Professional Issues Committee chairman for a number of years, developed standards that are now nationally and internationally accepted. I guess just very, very briefly, I want to say that Oregon ATSA, the local organization, is 100% behind this. And in fact, I know of no treaters that are not fully behind this. There has been a problem for years and years. I've written several articles in the Prosecutor and some other national magazines about the lack of experience, the lack of skills of generic mental health providers. You may not understand that generic health providers, and I'm talking about PhDs, psychiatrists, MSWs, have no training whatsoever in dealing with sex offenders. This is a serious problem in this area. As a result, we have people going to court with misinformation, being released when they shouldn't be released, going through sham treatment programs that simply do not work. Washington State Certified Sex Offender developed a certified sex offender program in 1992. They set standards. They set expectations. They set training expectations for every individual. Since that time, they've been extremely successful in developing a comprehensive treatment program that works through corrections, the judicial programs, and through treaters. It's only been through a managed program that this has been able to be successful. As a result, they are much more successful generally with sex offenders than we are here in Oregon, where we have not developed any method to supervise and manage sex offender treaters. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Mr. Harkin.
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, I'm going to summarize my written testimony by saying that I'm the president of the Oregon Adolescent Sex Offender Treatment Network. I'm also a juvenile probation officer and with a 21-plus years experience in adult and juvenile corrections. The OSOTAN organization is 100% behind this bill, and I will tell you that a probation officer's nightmare is to receive a youth or an adult from another jurisdiction where best standards are not being practiced.
Thank
you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Harkins. And I apologize again for the brief amount of time. This is an important bill, and we will be gathering more input on it, and I think it's my intention to move it forward. So I appreciate your work on this project. Thank you very much. That concludes the public hearing on House Bill 3233, and as much of our agenda as we can complete today, committee. Thank you very much. We're adjourned.